Dr. Roberts?
I'm all set.
Hi, David Rappaport here. Thank you so much for granting this interview.
Absolutely.
You know, in your marvelous book, Lessons from Little Rock, at one point, you identify the fact that whites controlled society completely in the entire hierarchic arrangements of things like education, you know, eating, marriage, theater going, amusement parks, regulations of all kinds. And then you assert that they must be crazy because they've created a kind of a topsy-turvy world. Can you talk a little bit about those moments that you recall as a youth when you knew right from wrong and you were right and they were wrong?
Well, when I was at that age, I saw it being totally unreasonable. I thought, somehow a mistake has been made here, and these folks don't seem to understand it. It was hard for me to figure out. Really had a difficult time trying to figure out what was going on, because it didn't seem right at all. And it turned out it wasn't right. It was absolutely wrong. So my assessment was correct in the beginning.
Well, it certainly was. And the kind of things that you endured that are so, as you say in your own book, you face such formidable barriers. How are you really able to resist the temptation to respond physically? It just seems to me quite remarkable. And to my students, when I ask them about, you know, what you would do, because, you know, you're the fellow in the film. I want my students to be connected to you in a way by listening to you now, and you strive for a nonviolent approach. How are you able to do that?
Well, I think it all stems from the fact that I had learned pretty early in life that fighting never resolved any issues. When you look historically at what we've tried to accomplish through fighting, wars all over the place, we still have wars. Even the war to end all wars didn't work. So fighting at any level makes no sense. And that was part of my thinking then and part of my thinking now. I try to avoid, if at all possible, any kind of encounter that might end up with fighting, because I know it leads you to nowhere. It just simply inflames the emotions. And when you look at what happened with these modern gangs, neighborhood gangs, there's always a need to kill one more because you killed one of mine. So it's never ending. We will finally decrease the population to zero if we have that sort of an attitude.
Well, I totally concur, and that's, you know, that approach has certainly proven itself time and time again, as we see around the world. And of course, your activism has been cited by so many people around the world as the model for social change. How does that make you feel as someone who's now trying to make sure that we don't forget the lessons that you fought for?
Well, it sounds pretty good, actually. And I'm glad to hear that there are people who have paid attention to those principles, because I think they weigh and count a lot more than principles that would suggest we need to kill people in order to make our ideas palatable. Now, there's no way on earth you can sell a principle by having to kill other people. That just makes no sense.
And, you know, the very people who, it's quite interesting that in all the stories of your going to Central High School, that the people who are seen as the great force in your defense are the 101st Airborne, who themselves, of course, were invaded Normandy and were there at the Battle of the Bulge in Bastogne. Instead of being at the point of the bayonet, which is what you were when the National Guard turned its attention to you, and what was it like to have the 101st behind you?
You know, that was actually pretty good. And I must say that I was called out recently by a middle school student when I said that having the 101st there gave me a lot of comfort, because I knew if things got really bad, they could mow people down on my day. They could just take people out. And the middle school student said, but didn't you just tell us that you embraced the principles of nonviolence? And I thought, wow, a very astute kid. So I had to rethink that one. And what I came up with was this. I am an imperfect human being, and that even though I embrace the principles of nonviolence, I am sure there are times in my life where I would give in to other forces and do things that I wouldn't be proud of. That's just the reality. Now, what I would like to do, what I'd hope to do as the future continues, is to become more nonviolent and less violent. I'm probably closer to the end of the continuum anyway. I lean toward nonviolence. So I could probably not by any stretch of the imagination be considered a violent person, but I do have violent tendencies. I know this, but I need to keep working on it, to keep erasing those. I see it as a lifetime activity.
That's so very honest and incredibly forthcoming of you. In the spirit of remembrance, there's certain people who emerge and their stories emerge in the telling of your story as a youth. Of course, I point to a film called Eyes on the Prize, and which I think does an interesting job of dissecting the day-to-day ridiculousness and horror of the experience. But there are several people, if you would be willing, whose stories stand out to me and very often to my students, in part because of a photograph that appears in their history book and also one that appears all over the world, which is the intimidation of Elizabeth Eckford when she arrived to school alone on a particular day in September of 1957. May I just ask you a little bit about, you know, your reaction when you heard about, you know, what kind of, you know, what had happened to her? She faced that mob, and in the film, you know, your colleague Ernest Green is seen very gallantly describing what it must have been like. But would you recount for the listeners of this interview what you felt upon hearing what had happened to her?
Actually, I was on the scene when that all happened. The history books and the history those in the archival messages do not include this often, although it is there. Elizabeth did arrive alone. I arrived alone shortly after that. I wasn't aware of her presence because the mob was so massive. Eventually, though, a group of reporters and photographers told me that Elizabeth was on the bench. They didn't know her name, of course, but they said there was another black student over there. And I walked over and talked to her. In fact, I tried to persuade her to walk home with me because I lived close by. But she said no, because even if she got to my house safely, she would have to figure out a way to get home. So she would just wait for the bus, which she did. And I understood, because that mob was entirely menacing. In fact, I think even on the Eyes on the Prize video, if you listen very carefully to the background noise, you can hear somebody yelling out, "Let's go, I got a rope, let's hang them." So that kind of menacing presence was enough to make your blood chill.
Well, that's just an incredible description of the sort of insidious way that your simple existence was threatened. And as you point out in your book, if I could quote you, this is but a microcosm of what happens even today as we struggle with many of the same issues that were present in 1957. And this book, your book, was not written yesterday. You're talking about,
exactly.
Is, you know, and it's really quite remarkable. And, you know, you also say that we must face our past with unflinching honesty if we're to determine the most appropriate next steps for our future. May I inquire what you think those next steps are, Dr. Roberts?
Well, I think one of the steps has to be more understanding about the historical record. In this country, we spent so many years under the aegis of Supreme Court decisions and other laws that applied constitutional support to the separation based on race. racial discrimination was legal for so many centuries, well over 300 years. It's hard to get rid of that by ignoring it. We have to address it head on. And I think if we had a generation of people who could face our history honestly and then make some conscious decisions to ferret out all of the systems and institutions that have been left in the wake of all of that, we could become a better society. So that, I see, as one. And then we have to alter our educational process so that not only would we teach kids truthful history, but we would also include courses on how to be better citizens, how to be people who cared about self and other, how to be better than those who came before them, that kind of thing.
That's very, very profound, how to be better than those who came before them. That's difficult in some of our cases because, you know, you coming before us and people like Dr. Kenneth Clark and Mamie Clark coming before you and embracing you. And I wonder, these are names that I think a lot of history students, I teach 11th grade history, need to know about. And if you would possibly comment on the Clarks and your relationship with them, because they are sometimes subsumed into the great volume of civil rights history without the recognition due them for their incredible contribution and their perseverance in the face of insurmountable odds. Would you mind commenting on your relationship with the Clarks? And
Sure. This was a couple, both psychologists, who had a real interest and professional desire to be active in trying to promote real change. So they conducted very important studies. More than that, they spoke out against a lot of the inequities in society. I recall being at UCLA years ago when Dr. Kenneth Clark gave a lecture. He sat there waiting to write down what he had to say. But as he talked, I didn't make any notes because I understood already what he was talking about. I had known. At the end of his talk, he said, white America would probably devise ways to live the ocean before they would ever agree to open closing this country. I was devastated and felt a sense of despair. But then later on, in the reception, I realized that Dr. Clark was not taking himself out of the fight. He was just publicly giving voice to despair. He was speaking words. But that was so significant to me. Because even if you are a person who understands what to be done and you're in the midst of it, you also experience and don't see the change. I think we need many more of the Drs. Clark.
Oh, that's beautifully put. And so I've taken so much of your time here. If I could conclude perhaps with your acumen, Arkansas, I know you live in California, but of course you'll be associated with Arkansas politics. There are a lot of people going to be associated with Arkansas politics in our on the headlines starting tomorrow, I guess, when Hillary Clinton announces her candidacy for president,
yes,
for president of the United States. So today is the eve of that. And if I look back at my history, in 2012, Arkansas went for Mitt Romney by 60%. In 2008, it was McCain at 58%. In 2004, it was Bush at 54%. But in 2000, it was 51%. And when you look at it, it's really 50,000 vote margin, which is really 25,000 voters just switching minds. And then you go back one more election to 1996, to Bill Clinton, 53%. Do you think that Hillary Clinton can swing Arkansas back to the Democrats, or is the trend towards conservatism insurmountable, in your opinion?
I don't think Hillary will have the same response that Bill got in Arkansas. I think over these past few years, Arkansas has become much more embedded on the right. When you look at the election of Representative Cotton from that state, young man who is a first-term representative, and what he has been saying publicly and the stuff that he's been outlining for agendas in Congress. I don't think Arkansas has yet evolved, to put it mildly.
Well, that's a candid and a very apt citation of evidence in face of any thesis that would indicate that Arkansas would be moving towards progressivism. I know that your education and your experience at in Little Rock certainly fueled your own academic interest, Dr. Roberts. You graduated from the CSU system with. You, of course, got a degree at UCLA, a PhD at Southern Illinois, and were presented with a Congressional Gold Medal before the turn of the century in 1999. Was that particularly gratifying for you, sir?
Well, I think so. I think education has always been really necessary and important and breathing in life for me. And then to have the recognition from Congress that our group deserves to have it is very exciting. We have a lot of interest in symbols in this country, markers in space and time. So, you know, when our recognition by being granted the Congressional Gold Medal stands is a permanent marker in time and space. So as new people come on the scene, that becomes a beacon for them. And I think it was important to have that happen.
Well, I am very grateful for this opportunity to interact with you and interview you, sir. You know, when I look at you as a young fellow on the screen and I see your picture adorning your book, Lessons from Little Rock, Terrence Roberts, one of the Little Rock Nine, I'm just reminded about the fascination that we have as we open the door to our past, and with your fine writing, we're able to do that. And your tremendous honesty—it's a story of your own great personal strength, sir. And thank you so much for sharing it in writing, and thank you so much for sharing it here orally, in this brief interview.
Well, thank you for inviting me in. My pleasure.
Good day, Dr. Roberts. Take care.
Good day.